Thank you, John. Hi, everybody. This might be a little bit different, but could everybody please stand up? Put your coffees down. Put your name tags down. Yeah. I promised my wife that I would kuki yomu, which is read the air in this room, before I did this. But maybe I'm making a mistake. But mistakes are how we learn their information. This might be a little bit different from. I looked at some of the other speakers that you had, famed neurologists from MIT. I can only speak my truth today. Can you raise your hands up like that with the palms facing each other so your palms are facing each other? Yeah, just shake them up there a little bit. Yeah? Greet the day. Yeah? Now, because you have a little bit of imagination, you can imagine a color going between your palms. Yeah? A color. Just shake them a little bit if you can. Yeah? Now, when I said color, you already thought of a color. Yeah? You picked a color. Maybe it was yellow and green, Oakland A's colors. Maybe it's a rainbow. Maybe it's your wonderful fuchsia, bougainvillea fuchsia, whatever it is. And you imagine that color, and you keep that shaking, and start to bring the hands down. And imagine that color passing between your palms, and bring your hands to either side of your head. Keep them shaking with the palms facing each other. Yeah? And now that color is going through your head, going through that fur-covered computer on the top of your neck. And it's going right through you. And if you close your eyes for a moment, you can actually see that color emanating between your hands because of your incredible ability of your imagination. Now you're going to bring that color bar that's now passing between your hands in front of you. And bring it out in front of you. And now start to push it together. Where it was shaking, now it's pushing together. Pushing together a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer. Can you feel it? Can you actually feel something in there? There's like a thing there, yeah? Now a little tighter, tighter. Compress it, compress it, compress it, compress it. Ooh, I love that sound. My favorite sound in the world. Yes? Now, no, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it, hold it. Now, the thing that you summon from the skies and you pick the color because you have that imagination and it passes through your brain and then you actually felt it as you compress it together and now you heard that the glorious sound of two hands clapping and now you put those things together and you hold it right now. But because we are people, because we are artists, let it go. Good morning. In working on the Buckminster Fuller piece, one of the first things that he comes from the Mormon background, a fellow named Douglas Jacobs. And the first thing that, one of the first things he said, the first rehearsals, was he brought to me, and I'm sure this might be discovered territory, but the idea of testimony. And in the Mormon church, testimony comes from the what word? Testicles, exactly. And originally, you place your hand on a Bible and you said like that, yeah? But originally, in the Mormon church, you didn't place your hand on the Bible. You placed your hand on the thing that was most dear to you, your testicles. And you spoke your truth from that place. So I'd like to testify today a little bit about my personal truth, my personal theology. So thank you for giving me this form, John, and the Universalist Unitarian Church. Very briefly, when John called me regarding this gig, I said my favorite three-letter word, which is yes. Without really thinking. But then I started to think a little bit about my background in Unitarian Universalist world. And when I lived in Pasadena, I used to go to the neighborhood church there in Pasadena. And Reverend Lovely, that's his actual name, held court there. And he took the idea of going out into the world and experiencing things and bringing back that information very seriously. And where he would go at the time, he was going to Bosnia. He was going to Somalia. And he would invariably start his talk, his Sunday morning talk, about the craters that he saw, the bloodstains that he saw, the fact that they had to wear tennis shoes in Sarajevo because they knew they had to run at any moment. And he'd somehow wind it around by the end of the talk into this beautiful, I don't want to say silver lining, but this incredibly elusive and necessary kind of truth that he found in these places. And I started to go. And every time, and he'd be gone, so if he wasn't there, I'd go, oh, I'd sit through it, I'd do the singing, and it'd be okay. But then when he came back, he'd gone to another far-flung place, another place where strife was rampant. And he'd start, well, we were in, you know, there were the Ebola virus had just broken out, and you know, and I thought, oh, he's never going to make it. He's not going to bring it around this time. And he did. Every single time he was able to bring it back around to that silver lining. That is my goal today. The blurb on this said that In Search of the Mask of Satori. I recently got, I want to say recently, a few years ago, I got a grant to study mask in every culture from the Fox Fellowship, and they sent me around the world. And I went, well, I'm seeking Satori, Japanese word for enlightenment. And so what did I do? I went to Google and I looked up masks and Satori, because there is a famous Italian mask maker named Armletto Sartori, and I thought, oh well, I'll go and study with him in Italy. And I misspelled in Sartori and instead got Satori, and realized that was the mask that I was seeking. I've been an actor since I was 8 years old, a professional actor. I don't do this because I want to. I do it because if I don't, I'll die. This is important to me as breath. And I'm very fortunate to be able to ply my craft and all, for all these years. And if I'm going to testify today, it's going to be about my journey along those lines. W.H. Auden said, maybe famously, that the difference between an artist and a craftsman is that a craftsman knows what his final product is going to be. So today, I'm not sure what my final product will be. Going to try to enter this this talk as an artist. Personal theology. I'm a storyteller, and I think that your personal theology might be the stories that you tell yourself to make sense of the world. The stories that enlarge us, that make us feel just that little bit more part of something larger, are the stories that I'm most attracted to. So I was particularly enthused to come to this church. My usual church is the theater. But of course, it has that same peaked roof. There's beautiful brocade curtain, velvet curtain right over there, luring me. But this, I find myself in a church. And the most important thing, element to me of a church is the audience. So I appreciate your eyeballs, each and every one. When I entered just now, I had a little entrance right here. Right? He introduced me, and I entered. Now, there's 1,000 ways to make an entrance. Hidden in the word entrance is the word entrance. So when someone enters the stage and you see someone come on stage, there are three ways you can be: impelled, compelled, or repelled. Usually within the first 0.03 seconds, we decide whether we're repelled. And we decide whether we're compelled a little bit later. Hopefully I can prove to be compelling today. One of the ways that we like to do that, my fellow clown at Cirque du Soleil, Sean Kempton, used to say, man, you got to dilate. You really got to dilate. You're not dilating. You really got to dilate. And that idea of just opening up and smelling the air, I used the term earlier that my wife Momo introduced me to, which is Yuki Kukiyomu. Kuki is perfect, actually. And the idea of smelling the air, of reading the air, and getting a sense of what is needed in the moment. Mary Oliver said, maybe famously as well, pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. I have lived an astonishing life, and I want to tell a little bit more about it. With that in mind, just the other day I was listening to a radio interview of someone I very much respect, and I was struck by the fact that I was frustrated in my car because the speaker was talking about what he thought, and I was more interested not in what he thought, what he thinks, but who he is. So a lot of these ideas that I'm trying to present today are kind of an admonishment to go out and not so much use your brain to express yourself, but be aware that your body expresses yourself much more clearly. As an artist, I'm very interested in everything from the chin down, mm-hmm. not so much from the chin up. I have some students here from my workshops, and I normally put bags on their heads for one of the first exercises, because I'm really only interested in from here down. And we know that we get so much more information from body language than we do from language. I only refer to a recent handshake with a Japanese prime minister to be able to see how someone is and not what they say. So, who am I? Let me take you back to seven-year-old Ronnie. My grandmother, Elizabeth Park Dunlop Hill Johnson Siegfried Campbell. Yes, she was married seven times. They all died. I gave her away twice, two of her marriages, because of course her father wasn't around. She would read me bedtime stories, but I was a pretty bright kid, and so she was reading me The Hobbit, and she got to the final page, and she said, "You want to move on to Lord of the Rings?" I said, "I don't know." She said, "Well, what else?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "What else you got?" And she started in on, believe it or not, she pulled out her old, weathered, earmarked version of Shakespeare's collected works, and she started in on Macbeth, so Fowl and Faraday I had not seen. At 7 years old, I was hooked. It had swords, it had witches, it had people untimely ripped. That was heaven to me. And it was in a language that made no sense but made a deeper sense. And my grandmother was from Scotland, so the more she spoke, the thicker that Scottish brogue came out, and that hooked me on the life of theater. Not long after that, one of her husbands died. Now, we had a tradition that when her husband died, she'd take the inheritance and she'd spend it on me. But not really specifically me, but on world travels. So what we did was she would immediately buy plane tickets and we would fly to Europe. And at 8 years old, I was her little companion. When I was 14, I was her little companion. When I was 17, I was her driver. And slowly, that's how I discovered Europe, basically. And on one of those journeys, we were in London. And we were at the Old Vic Theatre in London, seeing Richard Kiley in Man of La Mancha, the wonderful musical of Don Quixote. And I was struck by it. Now, as my grandmother tells the story every Thanksgiving, in fact, we only celebrated my grandmother's birthday on Thanksgiving because she never told us when she was born, so we never knew how old she was. But we celebrated on Thanksgiving, figuring the whole entire family would be together. And my grandmother would tell this same story every Thanksgiving. We saw Man of La Mancha, and if you know the show, he's singing The Impossible Dream at the very end, and that pin spot iris is down on his face, and that slight smile in the midst of his tragedy, the corners of his mouth with that light gravity, while the rest, that night of the woeful countenance, he's called, in that deathbed, and that little corner of the mouth glimmer of the impossible dream. Even now, I can feel it. I went berserk as a 7-year-old kid, an 8-year-old kid. I thought a man had died in front of all of us. I did not see the curtain call. I did not see the finale. My head was, I was inconsolable. The audience filed out, and a kindly usher said, "What do we have here?" There was this puddle of tears, little boy. And my grandmother said, "Well, he's very affected by the play." I said, the usher took us down underneath the stage at the Old Vic Theater, where the dressing rooms are, and I looked in a little doorway, and there was Richard Kiley with cold cream they used to use on their face, taking his makeup off and his beard off, and he said, "What do we have here?" And that was resurrection to me. That's when I think the hook went in. And from that point on, I came back. I have 2 little brothers. We started doing plays. I've been doing them ever since. Along those lines, Shakespeare himself said that all the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and each man in his time plays many parts, the acts being 7 ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in his nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly, to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. And then the soldier, full of strange oaths, and bearded like a pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, with fair round belly and good capon line, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The 6th age shifts to the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice now turned toward childish treble, or pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. So you can see why I'm hooked. Confucius said, and that's how I'm going to pull somebody today, I'm not sure, but Confucius said, and I always think of Confucius as confuse us. I hear, I forget. I see, I remember. I do, I understand. You're probably familiar with this. I've often found that I'll read something, I'll get a text, and it'll go... I'll listen to a book on tape, and it'll hold on a little bit. Yeah. But boy, when I go and learn some lines and go and do the piece of literature, it's in. So it's in my body, in my bones, in my marrow. So that's what I'm looking for in this world. When I say I do, I understand, it kind of leads us to Buckminster Fuller, who, when I was talking to Allegra Fuller, his daughter, who was at the time about 17, 8 or 9, wonderful woman, long gray hair, just like my mom's long gray hair. And she said, you know, when Bucky said understand, he really meant it physically. And he meant standing under, really using it as a roof for him, that understanding. So let's see if we can all understand this. I'm going to take a piece of manila rope, yes? And at the end of this manila rope, I'm going to splice in a piece of nylon rope. Yes, and at the end of the nylon rope, I'm going to splice in a piece of cotton rope. Right? Now I'll make the simplest knot I know, which is to go 360 degrees in this plane, 360 degrees in this plane. Right? I'm not going to pull it tight. So there's the knot. Yes, on the manila rope. Now the rope has not done this. I have done this to the rope. At any rate, I'm going to slide the knot along. Right? And now it's on the nylon. So I'll keep sliding. And now it's on the cotton. And suddenly it slips off the end of the rope. Where? We say the knot is a pattern integrity. It wasn't the nylon, it wasn't the cotton, it wasn't the manila. Nylon, cotton, manila. Each of those is good to let us know the knot shape, what its pattern was. But the knot was any one of them at all. The knot has an integrity all its own. So part of my personal theology is that a human life is like that knot sliding along the rope. I got to play Buckminster Fuller, so I got to kind of be inside him. So I feel him a little bit in here. Yeah, he's in this room a little bit. Yeah. So that pattern integrity idea, let me just continue with that. What is, can I use this term, wonderful novelist and cartoonist? Yeah. You're perfect. You're absolutely perfect. Yeah. Can you just stand there for a second? Da Vinci Man, right? Let's give him a hat. Yeah. Classical value. Yeah. So, what is man? Let's see. We're just going to use you as an experiment. It's a 28-jointed adapter-based biped, an electrochemical reduction plant. Yeah. I know it's shocking. Integral with segregated stowage and special energy extracts and storage batteries. 62,000 miles of capillaries. Millions of warning signal conveyor systems, crushers. Yeah, you got crushers? Crushers? Yeah, there's the crushers. And cranes. Yes, of which the arms are magnificent 23 jointed affairs, the self-servicing and lubricating systems, the whole extraordinarily complex mechanism, serviceable for 78, 9 years, well tuned, yes, guided with exquisite precision from a turret, yes, the turret control being closely allied with the air conditioning intake and exhaust, and the main fuel intake. Oh. There are also two sound wave and sound direction finder recording diaphragms, a filing and instant reference system, and an expertly devised analytical laboratory. Large enough not only to contain every last and minute event of up to 70 years' experience or more, but to extend that experience with relative accuracy to all corners of the observed universe. The whole system is directly and simply mobile.
Yes, on land.
Yes. And in water, and indirectly mobile in air. Men and women merely players indeed. Man is a super galaxy of galaxies of slip knots. Thank you. We're all that, yeah? We're all that. Man is a super galaxy of galaxies of slipknots sliding some totally along in a complex here we are, of reciprocal slipknot principles in a complex of a sociable, limitedly tunable, sensorially apprehendable in knottings of slippable principles. It's the same thing I saw when you let the colors go. Make sense? Yeah? So playing Bucky and giving them these ideas coming into my head and me starting to see myself as a mechanism, really, and my brain is another part of the mechanism, and my feeling center as maybe the deepest thing that I have and the most important thing I have, it also put me through some changes. The other thing that put me through some changes is here's a beautiful wall. This is a wall right now, but really it's like-minded wall molecules deciding at this particular moment in space-time to be a wall. Now, when you start to see the world like that, everything seems a little bit, oh boy, what have I got? What do I actually have? Everything is malleable. Malleable meaning changeable, yeah? Recently, my wife and I took a jewelry class, and I made this bracelet. It was a coin at one time, or a couple coins. Yeah? And once we saw that, we both were like, wow, everything can be melted down. And it changes you a little bit and makes you kind of go, what do I actually have? And so the opportunity to talk about my personal theology that makes me go, okay, what do I really believe? So, like-minded chair molecules, like-minded podium molecules in this world. We know from the Buddhist, or we hear from the Buddhist that the world is that life is suffering, yeah, and it is the best kind. And being inside that suffering, being alive to suffer, is what I consider our greatest gift. And that suffering might not be suffering, because I see it more as being in the tube. And I'll explain. When I was playing Buckminster Fuller, there was a thing called West Coast Live, and I had to interview David Bodanis, who wrote the autobiography of the theory E equals MC squared. Now, I don't know my times tables. I don't know what 7 times 9 is. That's confusing to me. I'm not good at... I've never been good at math. That's probably why I'm an actor. One of the reasons. So I was nervous about this. So I went to... what was the old bookstore on Market Street? It's gone now. Stacy? Yeah. Well, he had a reading there. And I thought, oh boy, I'll go to the book signing reading, and I'll get some really good questions, and that'll just send him off, and I'll be okay. Because I was really concerned about coming off. I'm not Buckminster Fuller. I'm Ron Campbell. Am I going to come off like an idiot on live radio? So I wanted to ask him some really specific, strong questions. It turned out he was an extraordinary person whose Oxford class, he has people do reports on, say, Einstein, but he says, I'm not interested in what he did. I'm interested in why. And he wasn't able to explain energy or mass times the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. That doesn't compute to me. But he was able to explain to me the equal sign. And originally the equal sign was 2 arrows going in both directions. Yeah? Makes sense, yeah? But when the typewriter came on, they didn't really have that yet, but they did have the dash, so they offset a dash, and that became the equal sign. That's the only reason why. It's the typewriter we have to thank for the equal sign. Bodanis explained to me that the equal sign, if you see it as a tube, like, you know, the toilet paper tube that you have when you're done with your toilet paper, just imagine the equal sign as that. And that easy flow, that absolute flow of air going between those two things is indeed the equal sign. So life, to me, is living inside that equal sign. And if it's difficult, it's exactly what you're going to get out of it. It's what you put into it. Yeah. My basketball coach said the same thing. But that sense of cooperation, I think, extends to a life in the theater. In the improv world, they have a thing called yes and. So you don't deny someone's proposal. You say, yes, and I'm the king of the world. Yes, and I'm your court jester. Not, no, you're not. I'm the king of the world. Yeah? Then we have those weird handshakes coming up. You follow me? So that yes and made so much sense to me. And I, as I mentioned before, yes is my favorite word. And I think it was at the Universalist Unitarian Church in Pasadena that I was looking at the hymnal and I came across the, you probably all know it, the E.E. Cummings quote, we thank you, Lord, for most this amazing day, for the leafing greenly spirit of trees and the true blue dream of sky, and for everything that is natural, that is infinite, that is yes. Hopefully you imagine that all in lowercase. So I'd like to share a little bit of my own thoughts on yes. I call this the Prince. Now you have to imagine this a little bit in the voice of George Carlin. The Prince. Yes and no. The rules of art of life are written by the beholder, and if you've ever tried to write rules while holding a bee, it can be very difficult. Now, the artist offers a big, bountiful yes, and it sounds like everything. An orgasm and a death rattle, a fart and a cri de coeur. Yes is a question and a call to arms. No is an amputation and a gelding. No is nothing, a cul-de-sac in a tract development. No severs the artery, bites the tongue, kills the party, aborts the fetus, scrapes the palate, bombs the hospital of yes. Yes bounces. No sinks forever. Yes shines like the eyes of the eager. No spray paints the monument. No is a sledgehammer. Yes is the fulcrum, the arrow and the bow. No steals. Yes borrows. No leers, while yes smiles. No says no to yes. Yes says yes to no. Yes listens, and no is deaf and dumb and never dreams. Yes dreams all the time. Yes takes the car out for a drive. No has a head on with a stranger. No runs out of gas, and yes survives on fumes. No gives bad directions. Yes gets lost and doesn't care. Yes shoots and scores. No sits on the bench. Yes swallows. No vomits. Yes vomits too sometimes. Yes has more fun than no. Unless yes needs a little no. No is necessary. No is essential. Yes is optional. Yes is yeserific. No is a dictator. Yes is a prince. So, save some of that for after the show. So, I know you had famed neurologists standing right here, so I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't bring a little scientific support to my ideas here. Charles Lamb, who I'm going to get this right, otolaryngologist at Johns Hopkins, which is the study of brain activity. In studying it, he he was very interested in the MRI, but he was also a jazz musician. And he was interested in what happens to the brain on jazz. Now, everybody does it. They close their eyes when they're trying to block out other things, when they pray, when they play a solo. And maybe it's to access that, what is the medial prefrontal cortex, maybe that third eye, that area right there, which is the area that when you put someone in an MRI and you ask them to talk about themselves, to give their own personal theology, it lights up. When you confess, it lights up. Yeah? Now, the other part that lights up on your brain when you're saying no, when you're saying, uh-uh, don't do that, be careful, watch out, fear, all those things, that's the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That lights up. So he was very interested in jazz musician, and he wanted to get jazz musicians inside an MRI machine and have them improvise. He had a problem because you can't put metal in one of those things, those magnetic imaging machines. So he had made a plastic saxophone. And he got a guy in there, a musician he respected, and he had him play the basic standard, and the dorsolateral was coming up because he was playing a standard. When he had him do free jazz, when he had him improvise, he continued to watch, and that was still going faintly, but what he noticed was that the places that didn't light up were that no area. And shutting off that no area, to me, is one of my jobs as an improviser, as an actor, and most importantly, as a clown. And something happens with each of the roles I play. Just as Buckminster Fuller leaked into me, also did the King of the Clowns in Cirque du Soleil show, as did recently the Dybbuk. Just did a one-man show for the Dybbuk, leaked into me. So they're inside here a little bit, kind of fighting for areas. My certainty that I am who I am is probably all connected here. And my uncertainty is over on the dorsolateral side, and I want that to not light up when I am performing. I want to think not what I should not do, but what should I do? That's part of my personal theology. Sometimes you have to close your eyes. Which brings us to my favorite body part. The chin. There's a branch of psychology, I don't know what it is, but I had a photographer who introduced it to me, and I thought it was so interesting. The idea that you can feel something in a certain place, literally an area, and forgive me for probably people who know more about this idea, but that I have an idea here, I have a feeling here, I'm depressed here, I'm pissed off here. And I can step out of that area and leave it all there and continue my life. And that idea informed a workshop technique that I use. Has anyone ever, imagine back when you were in elementary school and you played four square? Yes?
Yeah.
You remember those days? Yeah, a four square champion here, clearly. Yeah. So imagine that I have a four square court right here. I know you're recording. A little four square court right here. And I'm in the center of the four lines. Does that make sense? So when I'm down here, I'm in my happy area. And I'm definitely happy over here. I should see something that is really, I'm happy to be performing here. And right here is my sad area. And that's it. That's the sad area. And if I step into this quadrant, it is my pissed off area. And something happens, something curdled inside me, and I allow for my chin down to let that happen. And over here is my afraid area. There's a bunch of people watching me. All those eyeballs are on me right now. But I love it. Does that make sense? I said, does that make sense?
Yes.
I hope so.
You got me?
Yeah. So, in this my journey into mask, one of the things I found was that my chin started to express a lot more. This is a paper plate. I've scrawled nothing on it really to give you much information about this character, but since silence is golden, and my mouth is not really helping me because it's just telling you what I think, I want to show you maybe a little bit about what I feel. I'm going to start in the middle of my quadrant, so in a nice neutral. Sculpt me. So I'm allowing the world, hopefully in my personal theology, to sculpt me rather than try to sculpt it. Yeah? There are movers and shakers out there. I'm not one of them. I'm again trying to uphold that Mary Oliver's idea of pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. And one of the only ways I can tell about these emotions is by not talking, by shutting the hell up. Some people say God is available, present in nature. When thunder's crashing, my wife hates the thunders, she calls it, because she just doesn't like it. Yeah, but that is a kind of wrathful God speaking to us. Yeah, no, not to me. To me, my personal God is really, really quiet. Bless you. And only available in those quietest moments. And the quietest moment, my favorite quiet moment, is that moment before the laugh. Just before the laugh. Not, so you say a joke, right there, that little spot, that's where God is revealed to me. I don't know if it was the Buddhists who said, if you're going to speak, make sure you're improving on silence. And I was gratified to see that Wendell Berry was quoted in your little in the signage outside, and he says, I'm sure you're aware of his wonderful poem, How to Make a Poem, but he says, make a poem that does not disturb the silence from which it came. And so that's kind of my attempt. I have a sailboat, and I was in the middle of, it was the 15th of February, and I was in Santa Monica Bay, and there were a bunch of those inflatable Valentine's Day balloons, those kind of metal balloon type things floating on the water out there. Clearly the day before there had been cruise ships or something, and they were out there. I was with my godson. I said, let's get those. Let's get them. and without motor, all the tacking, and, you know, we, and him with a whisker pole, we got as many as we could, and we got him, you know, and we were cleaning up the bay in a really exciting way, actually. The wind was quite, you know, it was blowing, but we got most of them, and about halfway through, a pod of dolphins just rose up around us. So we're seeing, there's another one over there. We go, and the dolphins came with us. And it was an extraordinary experience. Tears were in my eyes as I was laughing. And we got to the last one, and he had a hard time. There was no string attached in the bottom. It was just kind of, we couldn't get it. And we tried and tried, and the wind was blowing, and it wasn't, and we finally said, I said, forget it. We're going in. That's it. We're done for the day. And we turned around, and the dolphins disappeared. And I've always felt that the dolphins were like, yay, you guys are cleaning up. Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, you're not going to get that one? Goodbye. Right after that, we were on the water, and I usually keep a little boombox. I love to have music playing when I'm on the boat, and I said, Jake, turn that off for a second. As we go in, I just want to hear the earth a little bit here, and it left this thought. This is an open letter that I wrote to my own mind. It's called Just Shut Up. Dear me, why all the chatter? Just shut up. You fill the spaces where the breeze of simple contentment could flow with your gibbering static. Just shut up. I'm talking to you, me. Just shut up. Listen. Your mind's insistence to discuss everything you see, feel, smell, and hear, your squawk box of priorities, your opinions, your notions and endlessly mutating theories, the familiar list of regrets you like to shuffle through, your plan to do this or that or the other thing, the utterly random grooves you carve, your ad nauseum musings, your zombie mantras of what should I, why didn't I, when will I, did I? Just shut up. All that thinking about thinking, just shut up. Your brain is a minefield with tripwires of self-reflection, with buried but ticking mortars of decisions made, unmade, regretted. Let it go fallow once in a while. Just shut up. When you do, when your mind's mouth stops its yapping, when the gibbering monologuist with a microphone in your head runs dry, when the talkie of your walkie takes a breather, that's when you can hear it. The giddy swirl, the custom embrace of the world snug and right around you, the wordless knowing that you are exactly where you are. And then the newscast starts again, and the diuretic commentary resumes, and the happiness dives under, waiting for the next stillness to show its bright flipper in the sunlight. So I don't know where we are on time, but we bring back to Don Quixote. Last year I got to play Don Quixote, not in Man of La Mancha, but in an actual adaptation of the two books of Don Quixote, under mask, in a full mask production at the Marin Shakespeare Theater. And the way that worked was that depending on the character, there were 50 masks in the show, designed by David Posnanter, and the fellows with smaller parts had a full mask, and And me and Sancho Panza, we had basically a quarter mass with just our cheekbones and funny nose and everything. So I had my mouth available. And I knew that that corner of my mouth had to lift, had to have a little bit of gravity. And the fact that I got to play the guy that got me into this, just as Richard Kiley got to play him for so many years, and I got to play him too, really brought me into a nice rounded circle. Seinfeld has that. He has that in his facial structure. When things are bad, there's a little bit of, man, this is really bad. Mm-hmm. And that little corner of the that little light gravity in the corner of the mouth, that might be if I distilled down my personal theology, it would be keep smiling. But there's a warning. Warning. A smile is like an invitation to the party in your mouth. It's like a cradle of future giggles. It's like a hammock hung between invisible trees. It's like a balloon animal filled with the helium of possibilities. It's like a welcome mat for the eyes. A smile can also be like the grill of a Chrysler. Like a parenthesis taking a break and lying down. Like a supine moon. Like a ladle of teeth. Or an upturned scythe. A smile can also be like an anthropological dig in your face where great treasures are revealed. A harbinger of risk-taking. Like a secret agreement. Like a fissure in the formality. Like a crack in the ice. Or a favorite mask. A smile is like a suspension bridge that you build between your cheeks where joyous little cars travel all day and all night on their way to fun. Warning. Many smiles are infectious, even to yourself. Thank you. Keep smiling. Thank you.
Did you want to answer questions?
Okay. Oh, there's a fine example of manhood there.
How did you know that I would perform?
Well, because I have been doing what's called victim work at Teatro Zanzani and Cirque du Soleil and for a long time. And you have the spark, my friend. Yeah. Usually you don't want someone who's too enthusiastic because they can ruin you. They can ruin your bit. Yeah, and you were a bit enthusiastic, I must say. But you also don't want somebody who is really, really painfully shy because the audience feels their pain.
Yeah.
We used to call them involunteers. Yeah.
I saw you in Bucky a few years ago, and I want to know, when you're preparing for a part, I've always wondered this about a professional actor. You know, you get the part, then what do you do? How do you get ready?
Learn the lines?
Yeah.
I don't know, my wife will probably tell you a little bit better. I pore over it. I pore over it. It's a combination of really a lot of preparation and then getting there and being like a hypnotist assistant, open to suggestion. And for Bucky, they put me and Doug Jacobs in a room for 3 weeks to just yell at each other. And we had all this text. We started with a 600-page text. And I would the highlighter, the yellow highlighter, or it could be green, or, you know, that yellow highlighter, that to me is my sword. And what I wanted to say in the show, I yellowed. And what he wanted me to say in the show, he yellowed. And then we'd put the pages and see what we both wanted to do. And oftentimes it was, and we picked certain themes like water, and that became how that came about. But yeah, I tend to work from the outside in, as you can kind of maybe tell, because there was no way that I was going to have the mind of Buckminster Fuller, but to represent him, I wanted to feel him. He had this habit and this kind of Puritan spine. So I pick certain things when I, to answer your question, I pick whether a character is direct or indirect, light or heavy, sustained or broken, fast or slow, big or small. So if someone is light, indirect, and broken, he might say, "Oh, well, you want to go to McDonald's? Don't go there." But if I'm direct, sustained, and heavy, I might say, "McDonald's. First thing, drive down the hill." So those kind of things start to inform my physicality, and hopefully, from the outside, it slowly bleeds into me.
In the context of your yes-no diorama there, how would you resist?
When do you say no?
No. In the world where we want to resist things that are wrong, how do you bring that beneficial yes to play and still resist?
I think that push does come to shove. If more people had said no in Nazi Germany, we might not have, you know, had that. I study a martial art, Aikido, and have for 17 years. And before that, I did Aikido. And before that, I studied karate with, believe it or not, Chuck Norris. Yeah. And the principle of Aikido, of course, is taking that energy, and your resistance really is using that energy and changing it. So I think that the yes can become a yes and. I'm this way, I'm this way, I'm this way. Yes, you are, and you're also this way. When I'll use it. So if you're coming toward me, but if I turn like this, I've just done a simple tension, but now we're both facing the same way. So if you got to clean your room, or your spouse says, "You got to do this," and you go, "Yes, that's true, but look at this beautiful problem." I'm using that no energy and going, "What is yes?" If that answers your question or evades your question, as an apolitical person,
does the room get cleaned?
Does the room get clean? Yeah. You have to ask my wife. No. Absolutely not. Yeah. But look at this glorious mess.
So I never thought of speaking. Of course, I never had Don Quixote and Buckminster Fuller in the same sentence. And as I put that in that sentence in my head, I thought they were both extremely men of their times, and yet N.O.T., not of their times. Because Bucky Fuller, you know, I never think of him as a philosopher, and of course that is deeply what he is. He's an engineer on top of this other.
Absolutely.
And would you correct this sentence for me? Is it the word Dymaxion, and is it anticipatory three-dimensional design science? Is that his? Do you know that term?
Yes, Dan.
Is that yes, Dan. And is that Dymaxion, or is that just his thingy?
That was his company, Dymaxion.
And it's
the Dymaxion
anticipatory
car.
Anticipatory
design science.
Okay.
Anticipatory design science. I think what I can't speak for I can't speak for Bucky. I can speak as Bucky, but I can't speak for Bucky. But I think he was the every word had a real significance. So even the word inside the words, so dyna for dynamic and ion. So he really didn't. He never wanted to say something. In fact, he talked about his talks being thinking out loud, and he didn't want to say something that was a maybe. In fact, he tried to, according to his grandson, Jamie, who has become a friend through doing Buckminster Fuller and lives in Santa Cruz, he tried to strike the word maybe from his vocabulary, and perhaps he didn't want to say it. And I can imagine with when the American Institute of Architects, you know, fired him because he wanted to or wouldn't take his designs that he actually gave them for modular housing that we could have all over and cure a lot of things. And when they said perhaps and something like that, and that drove him nuts. So whatever part of Buckminster Fuller has leaked into me doesn't like that, perhaps the P word either.
I have a lot of questions that are unformed, but I have your yes no shtick. Was that written by you, or who was the author?
By me.
And where do I get a copy of that?
Here's one. Check out my website. It's sorefeet.org. That's SORFEAT.org. And that'll have a link to another blog that has most of my writing and everything that I read today.
Got one.
Org.
Do you ever have trouble with the sense of humor being experienced by other people as offensive or inappropriate? And how can you turn that situation around?
Different cultures have different ideas of what is humorous. Recently I was in Japan, and at one point in our show, one of the clowns humps my leg. This gets great gales of laughter in America, North America, Canada, Europe, and once you get to Japan and someone humps the leg, just silence. Not in silence, but kind of waves of revulsion coming across the footlights. So we realized we had to find a different way to do that particular bit. And what we came up with was the humor of blame worked in the Japanese culture a little bit differently. So someone would do something, and then we blame the victim, the involuntary. So, again, it's that same Kukiyomo, feeling the air, reading the air. That rule applies in comedy as well, I think. We've all said jokes that fell flat, or, you know, that you wasn't the right audience for that particular thing. There's no joke that works, you know, on every culture. But I'm I'm constantly, I think I'm trying to find those jokes. I just did, just closed the speakeasy in San Francisco. It's a 1923 speakeasy immersive theater, and I played Eddie Cantor. And all of the material I culled from 1923 or earlier. And the jokes are not that funny. You know, a clown opened the door for me. I thought it was a nice gesture. And, yeah, see? But those kind of puns and that kind of thing, it was his stock and trade. What's interesting is that an audience in 2017 comes in there, and they're all dressed in 1920s garb. Everyone is in 1920s. It looks like the 1920s. And it doesn't take long for them to become infected with the idea that this is 1923, and that joke's not that funny, and that one's not that funny. But it's kind of like the airport, remember the movie Airport? The airport theory of comedy, that if they just keep coming, eventually you will laugh. Recently there was a Coca-Cola ad. I know it's Coca-Cola, but I thought it was brilliant. There was a guy got into a subway and was reading his iPad or something, and he started laughing. They started laughing, and they had hidden cameras, and he got the entire train car laughing just by infecting them. And that's why I feel that that my thesis on smiles is the same kind of thing, is that you mirror somebody, and there's some kind of thing that happens between you. And if you can make someone, I remember during Buckminster Fuller, just as a side note, sometimes people when they're listening, they go like this as if to let the ideas pour into their ear a little bit easier. But that's very close to this, which is close to this, which is close to this. And I found as Buckminster Fuller, with an open fourth wall, you know, that imaginary wall between the audience and the actor, with an open fourth wall, if I saw someone down, Bucky would come over and start really talking to that person, and then continue to talk and go and bring it back up, and I could actually pull their heads back to straight just through that invisible thing that happened between us. So, I don't know.
Hi, thanks for coming. You're such a beautiful human being, and thanks for sharing who you are. I'm so grateful. My question to you is, you know, it seems like you're doing this interplay of, you just seem to be such a master at being comfortable in your own skin. How much of it is being aware first? Because it sounds like you're judging how much to be aware of others, and then being enough aware of yourself in order to be able to convey that. Because in this world where my two little girls, I have a kindergartner and a fourth grader, you know, 5 and 9, it seems like the school system just seems so stultifying. How would I encourage that interplay? So it's two parts, you know. How much of it is that balance you're doing between self-acceptance and then the acceptance of others around you, or vice versa? And then how would you actually encourage that with somebody who's maybe been a whole day of rigidity, and just encourage them to be the best version of themselves?
Well, we all suffer from that incredible peer group pressure, you know, going in schools and that kind of thing, and having the right clothes and all those things are just, and you feel like your children be children for a little bit longer. I'm sure you're that's one of the frustrations. Maybe there's a balance, and maybe there's something that I have been able to explore a little bit because of my work in clowning, and if I knew I was going to trip, I'd let you know that I was going to trip, and I wouldn't have got that decidedly small giggle. But so I have to fool myself into thinking that I'm not going to trip, and that it's a surprise to me. I'm playing a little game with myself, and being absolutely expressive. In the martial art I mentioned in the Aido, if I make a facial expression, it's wrong. So it's the absolute, I'm not giving any tells, it's the poker face idea. And then the balance between those things, what your kids are going through, you know, sit right, and oh, that girl is not, all those things, that's the eido section of their life. Hopefully you give them the outlets to play in mud, have a tree house, make something ugly, you know, put a mask on and be someone else. And hopefully we all live in that world where we're gonna have those things where, oh, I don't fit in here, and I've got to conform to this thing, and I'm gonna let my freak flag fly. Yeah. So I'm parenting is probably one of the most difficult jobs you would ever have, and giving them those balances every once in a while. You go, I mean, and it's not just going to a water park; it's going to a muddy place. I don't know. That's the first thing that I think of.
Ron, we're beginning to run out of time.
Yes.
I don't know if this is possible or not. It's been a few years since I've seen the history and mystery of the universe, but I just remember the closing of it being very profound and wonderful. I know you've done the parts several hundred times. Something about dear people. I don't know if you could recreate that or not. If not, fine. I just thought...
I don't know. So the last line, and all I really can remember, is... and it's something that he used to say all the time, which was, thank you, darling people.
Yeah. Something like that.
So thank you, darling people.
Thank you.